Learn live in the classroom at Online Trading Academy's Financial Education Center in Bellevue. You'll have access to state-of-the-art workstations where you can learn on a professional trading platform. Text Cairo to 57682 to register for a free half-day workshop and learn more.
The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns in for Dory Monson today. We've had a packed show and we've got lots more coming up this hour. Let's get right into The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Top story.
So Sabrina Tate died on April 5th, just about a little over a week ago, in her RV, in a designated so-called safe zone. It was supposedly maintained by the city of Seattle. It was sort of a remnant of a project that Ed Murray had underway. And here's Sabrina in 2013 when she spoke to the Seattle Times.
I think it changed how I view homelessness. It's not... She was somebody who had a family, people that love her. She wasn't just somebody that society throws away.
That was Kelly Sevier, actually Sabrina's mother. Today, Zach and I talked to both of Sabrina's parents, Tommy Tate and Kelly Sevier. Zach, I don't know about you, but I was surprised and appreciative of the honesty and candor with which they spoke. And amidst such a horrible tragedy of losing their daughter. It's still right in the middle of the grieving process.
Yes, and this is the point of the grieving process where you really start to analyze, reanalyze, overanalyze everything you could or could not have done to help a child who is in the throes of addiction, who had been in the throes of addiction seemingly for over a decade. They experimented with different strategies. At first, you know, they tried the intervention, and interventions, man, I know that the show kind of glorifies it. And it seems like a great thing to do where you bring in everybody that you possibly can to try to express love for someone who is addicted to some sort of substance or flushing their life down the drain because of an addiction. Knowing people that have gone through it, the addict is more likely than not to just see it as everybody ganging up on them. Hmm. And where it seems like you're coming from a good-hearted position, yeah, where you want to make it seem like you have this support system in the mind of the addict, it's a lot of people condemning the life choices that they made. Those life choices have been rotten leading up to that intervention, but there's no 100% certain strategy. But I'm really angry at that show Intervention for kind of glorifying what it is and how effective it is. And I know sometimes it shows failures, but it's really inspired a lot of people to go that strategy first and then almost abandon the person if the intervention doesn't work. Like, okay, we got everybody together to say how much we love this person. That didn't work. Now let's move on to isolation.
Lots to unpack there, areas of agreement and disagreement from my perspective. But let's hear from Tommy, who's the father of Sabrina. He says they believed once upon a time they could help her.
At the point we thought that our family structure was strong enough that conversation and love would help get us to that solution. And obviously it didn't, at least from my perspective. I will admit I was naive about the services that were out there. And that was probably the best possible moment that we could have changed the course of her future. But my naivety at that time, that just family and church and religion and those kinds of things could be the solution, I was wrong.
Zach and I asked Kelly, Sabrina's mom, to describe the safe zone that Sabrina was living in.
The safe lot was basically a gravel dirt lot with huge potholes. I honestly don't know how some of the RVs were even able to get in there. There was a dumpster and a couple of porta potties there that, you know, I guess are the facilities. But in order for any of the residents in the safe lot to have electricity, they either have to have a generator of some kind, which, you know, a lot of these people living there, including Sabrina, you know, are unemployed. Many of them suffer from addiction issues. You know, it's just not someplace that even looked to be remotely safe.
Tommy says he was absolutely shocked by the conditions Sabrina was living in.
It's only a safe zone if, first of all, you think if it's protected, meaning some kind of boundaries around it where people can't come and go that don't belong there. Some kind of services, running water, outhouses are not services, excuse me. A real effort to get housing services for these folks. I know their caseworker was involved, but I'd love to know how much that person's hands were tied to try to get her housing services, whether she was in an RV or not in that safe zone. But the hour we spent out there last Wednesday, the word safe is not something that ever came to my mind.
Let's first react to this idea of a safe zone, because in my view, it's really a misnomer. It was a place for individuals to come and set up shop and basically just indulge their addictions and behaviors that had gotten them to that point in life in the first place. And at the time, I don't know if the city was still doing this, the city was spending $35,000 a month to allow people to live there. And I think there's been a couple of deaths just in the past few years. It's a complicated issue, and I don't want to pretend that it's very simple. I always remember that quote, for every complex issue, there's a solution that's fast, easy, and wrong. And that particularly applies to the homelessness epidemic in the state of Washington right now, and particularly downtown Seattle. But Zach, what I do know is I will never prop up a program that just allows the status quo to continue, that sets up a spot where people can continue their destructive behavior. The word charity, which I think applies here, is derived from the Latin for caritas. Caritas means to will the good of the other. What does that mean, to will the good of a homeless person? It doesn't mean to let them continue to shoot up heroin at will until they eventually kill themselves. Sometimes I think you can intervene, you can educate, you can give life skills, but at some point people sleep in the bed they make. And that's really hard to say, and you might say that's unloving and where's your compassion? But if someone is over 18, there's only so much you can do. But it's not the state's role to perpetuate the problem.
No, the state can help, but it's more than just the state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, show me a case where it was solely the state that intervened that turned someone like Sabrina's life around.
Right.
And I know that there are a lot of those out there that are quick to condemn the parents. One, because they were divorced and Sabrina's behavior started to change then when she was a teenager, an early teenager. But a lot of parents get divorced and their kids don't end up like this. A lot of people get divorced. You know, I'm not going to fault someone for a marriage that didn't work out. That would, you know, for a lot of us be incredibly hypocritical. And then when someone turns 18, it's almost impossible to force them to behave the way that you want them to. And I was learning over the course of that interview, it didn't seem as though Sabrina was seeking any sort of financial help from them, because you can always have strings attached to that. She was checking in periodically. And my first thought when I read this story and the way that it was presented was, okay, well, where were you guys over the past decade while she was going through this addiction? And it's so hard for a parent to ever admit to themselves that this is what their child has become. The power of denial is so incredibly strong, no matter how many warning signs they've shown you, no matter how many times, and you know, her father mentioned that he actually caught her with drug paraphernalia. If your child comes to you, as Sabrina did so often, and said, I'm turning my life around, things are getting better, I really am going to try to seek treatment, man, you can believe that 100 times. You can believe that 1,000 times. It's tough when they tell you that things are better than what they actually are not to believe them. And they were clearly shocked by their visit to the safe zone, because it was completely different than the way that Sabrina described it to them.
Sabrina's dad says, we are actually, in fact, all failing these people. Well, why?
Beyond a city, all people have a responsibility. They say it's the addict's fault. Now, addicts make choices, but we all make choices. But when we lose control, you know, the compassion of a society, and what makes a society and government, in my opinion, is how we take care of those people that cannot always take care of themselves. And I think in this case, and probably many other cases, I think society, the public, and the city, miserably.
And as you see again there, he is deflecting any sort of the blame from him and his ex-wife. And that's completely understandable. That's what I would be doing if I got the news I lost my child 12 days ago.
Well, there's lots of stages of grief, right?
There is.
Denial is one.
And deflecting any sort of personal responsibility is another one. I get where their head is at right now. They don't want to admit to themselves fully that anything they did led up to the death of Sabrina. That's exactly what I would be doing. I'm incredibly compassionate for them being angry at the lack of government support, the lack of societal support. That's what I would be shouting from the rooftops at this moment. But it brings open the larger issue, Greg, and why now we are really turning the tide on our opinions of quote-unquote junkies, which is what we used to write them off as.
Right.
Because
it dehumanizes people when you call them junkies.
Does. Yeah. It does. Because every one of us, if not now, in the near future, just based on statistical trends, is going to know someone who goes maybe, obviously not down as far this path of addiction as Sabrina did, but who suffers from some sort of opiate addiction. It is an epidemic in the United States, and it really takes, it's like any issue where there was once a marginalized group of people who are now, you know, recognized by the mainstream as human beings. It takes a personal connection with one, because the vision that we all have of a junkie has been severely altered since the 80s and the 90s, where, you know, someone with scars all over their face who is just in ragtags and committing crimes. We're all coming to know someone who could possibly end up like Sabrina.
And we talked about this a little bit off air, but I even have my own experiences with addiction that might seem trivial on the surface, but I think they're very real and very potent and actually very dangerous. I've struggled with bits of alcohol consumption in the past. I still struggle with weight. And you might say, oh, what's a few pounds? I'm sorry, if you're in the thralls of a food addiction, serious health problems can ensue. So it gives me more empathy for the guy on the side of the street and going, you know, I have the seeds of addiction in myself too. Thankfully, by the grace of God, you know, I'm here right now and that guy's on the side of the street. But we're talking about two different things here. And one is the role of the family, the friends, and the community in terms of the homeless person, and the role of the state and the role of the city. And I think those are two very, very different things. When it comes to the state, I think their primary role is to protect the vast majority of law-abiding citizens from needles on the side of the road, from feces on public property, and public safety should be their main issue. Instead, they have helped this problem balloon with the millions of dollars they're throwing at it to just set up places for people to indulge their habits. Well, they think, well, the problem is they just don't have a house to stay in. So we'll give them a free house. We'll put tons of taxpayer money to that. And then the problem persists. In fact, it actually expands and explodes because people see this is an area we can come to and shoot up.
But that's sometimes the case. That's sometimes the case, but not always the case. And that's what makes it such a complicated issue.
Yeah.
Because let's look at some other cities or in urban areas that have dealt with our homeless problem. Salt Lake City, where permanent housing, as decided by a very, very conservative state legislature, was the way to go. That when you give someone a sense of permanence, other issues become easier to address. That worked there. Would it work here? Sometimes, not all the time. That's why any consideration, any idea that's put forth for consideration, I think is worth talking about. And no matter how cockamamie the idea may be, listen to other communities that have implemented this idea. Let's first talk about your issue of public safety.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's going to be people that are going to be very upset by this phrase, but safe injection sites.
Right.
I've visited the safe injection site in Vancouver. I've spent time with a person who lives in that neighborhood. I've talked to business owners in that neighborhood, residents in that neighborhood who initially were opposed to the idea, as I was, who now fully support it because it did become a public safety issue. You talk about people shooting up on the streets.
Right.
That's been reduced. You talk about people overdosing in the bathroom. That's been reduced. You talk about needles found in the parks. That's been reduced. You talk about someone who has access to public health workers on a daily basis. That's been increased. And the success stories are overwhelming.
I don't want to discount your personal experience, but I could just as easily have someone on the air right now that has also visited a safe injection site that I've heard has a completely different take. In principle, I cannot support a safe injection site because there's no end in sight for that person to conquer their addiction. there needs to be some.
True.
What requirements are there for a safe injection site? Do they discourage that type of behavior?
Yes.
I would be all for a system that brought someone in and let them slowly detox off of the substance. Not just the place was like, hey, here, shoot up safely. I think that's a horrible idea and is not embodied in the spirit of charity or caritas like I spoke of before. But if you want to enter a program, if you really want to get back on track, we're not just going to cut you off cold turkey and make you have cold sweats and barf and vomit. And, you know, that would be horrible for a human being. I would get right behind a program where we said we'll slowly detox you off of this and get you right back on track.
Okay.
Offer you life skills. There is an abundance of services in the Seattle area. I know from firsthand experience, including a place, a transitional house that I volunteer at, that is ready and willing to help these people. But they are reaping the seeds that they have sown, and they won't bring themselves to utilize those services because they don't want to change.
And that's where the safe injection site comes in, because it's not an overnight decision. You're talking about a person that I think now you're driving to overdose in a bathroom in a nearby business. Instead of
they're driving themselves there, Zach.
No, but if there have been zero deaths on the safe injection site in Vancouver, there have been dozens of people who used to visit the safe injection site that now work at the safe injection site. There have been hundreds of success stories of people who have been eventually taken off of the drug because it's not an overnight process. And if you ask someone who on a cellular level, their body screams for this drug, okay, this is what you have to commit to, you're going to have a lot of people that are never going to participate in that program. If you ease them into it.
So might as well set up a free bastion where they can go shoot up that drug freely? That's a horrible idea.
But you're only saying it's a horrible idea because it's a horrible idea. And I'm giving you counterpoints as to why it's actually got. The end goal is harm reduction at first.
It's not harm reduction. They're harming themselves. They're checking out from society.
If Sabrina died. If she had shot up at a safe injection site, her chances of survival would have been much higher. There's no access to one in Seattle as of yet. There eventually will be. But she clearly didn't want to put herself. She brought it up every once in a while, as the family mentioned. Yes, I'm definitely going to go to
rehab. Let me ask you this. If you have a friend who's in the thralls of addiction, how do you proceed?
I've had two friends who OD'd and died in a back alley.
Seriously.
I'd rather they go to the safe injection site.
Yeah, but there's no guarantee, I don't want to downplay the significance of what you just told me, because you told me a really intimate detail about your life, and that's a very tragic situation, and I'm so sorry to have heard that. And so one thing I'm glad you told me, because that better informs me about your personal experience and your history and all of the reasoning that you've done to come to your current position on this. I still hold my ground, though.
See, it's a complicated issue, man. That's what I'm just saying. But
I'm glad we could add a little nuance.
But look into it, because I get the ickiness.
I have looked into it.
I get the ickiness but I don't know. I think that
you don't think there's people.
Your default position, sorry, is that this is a government-funded opium den. That's what I've heard several times from people who are against it.
Yes, makes the case,
But everything is about phrasing, right? Everything is about slant, and clearly describing it in that way is going to have a negative connotation. What I'm telling you is this isn't the only solution, but it's one that is working in the one place that it actually exists in North America, and that's Vancouver.
And I'll just say a safe injection site is also a curious phrasing. I think it's more of a check out of life site and indulge the worst part of your addiction. I appreciate the conversation. We might not agree on everything, but Greg Tomlin, Zach Burns, filling in for Dory Monson. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Dory Monson Show podcast, brought to you by Industrious Office. If you are on the search for your business's next home, there's simply no hotter place in the country than downtown Seattle right now. I went on a tour with Emily at Industrious Office. It's an amazing workspace right on 6th and Lenora, in the heart of all that Seattle has to offer. Visit industriousoffice.com/Cairo or call Emily to schedule a tour. Mention Cairo, receive your first month lease for free.
Hey there, business owners. Isn't this great? You can listen to Dory anytime, anywhere. If you're listening, your customers probably are too, so you need to give me a call. I can help you out and get your business placed right here in this show. 206-726-6819. It's Tina Sorensen, the General Sales Manager for Cairo Radio.
Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in for Dory Monson today. Both happy to be here.
I get one plug per show. Cairo Knights. Listen, me and G. Scott, 7 to 10 p.m.
I should be doing that.
No, that's all right.
Am I allowed to plug Seattle's Morning News?
Everyone knows about Seattle's Morning
Come
News.
Come on, this shameless self-promotion all around
me. Introduced to the market.
Hey, if I'm going to stick around till 2:30, I'm going to promote.
Follow me at Twitter at Tomlin Media. Bam, there it is. Okay, Zach, I really appreciated that discussion with you in the first segment. Look, for a second, if we could just pull back a little bit, you know, bird's eye view of talk radio. What is it that we're doing, why we're doing on the air? I think it's, one, obviously to keep people informed, let people know about current events. But then when we get to the opinion part of it, it's all in an effort to espouse views that try to make this nation a more perfect union. That's how I see it, honestly. And there's going to be controversy and there's going to be provocation in the process. But at the end of the day, really, I want to talk about ideas and espouse ideas that push us forward and lead to more human flourishing for the United States of America. Would you agree with that?
Amen. Yes.
You put your hand
you
over
it.
You vote
down.
For me for mayor, right?
You should write that down and send it to the bosses.
So that was my hope that people got away or took away from our conversation there about safe injection sites, about the homeless epidemic right now, because I try to stand firm on principle. I really do. I have a set of core beliefs. And at the same time, how do you combine that with a desire to want to compromise with people who are diametrically opposed to your viewpoint? And I try to let evidence and research rule the day. And at the same time, be willing to nudge a little bit. You're married. I'm married. We compromise on a daily basis.
Yeah.
America is a bit of a marriage, too.
I win every time.
You win every time. I knew it. One thing about you, you're so stinking tall, dude. When I see you in the hallways,
I'm physically imposing.
I'm just like, I know my ideas are going to dominate Zach, but I can't get over the fact that he's a whole head taller than me.
I am.
And it just, it's an
I'm a terrifying
intimidation.
Figure.
So anyways, that's my little 2-minute spiel right there. But do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I do. And I do appreciate that. You know, I think you and I have the same goals when it comes to talk radio. The first goal, above all else, of course, is to entertain. But it goes beyond that. And then
yeah, I forgot about that.
After that, what you want to do with it is up to you. And certainly my career has evolved quite a bit since my humble beginnings as a character named the Breeze Boy on an oldie station. Yeah, that was
the longevity
was a
of that
rough
wasn't
year.
Very, yeah.
Yeah, really rough year. But then going from that to a Howard Stern type radio into something that I think has become more meaningful. And in the end, think that radio stations and media as a whole, certainly this station anyway,
yeah,
should provide some sort of service. And, you know, I think that conversation hopefully opens some eyes. Just understand that when you first hear the introduction of a new idea, keep in mind that oftentimes people are going to frame it to fit their narrative. It doesn't,
for sure.
And I'll do the same thing. Push back on me, push back on Greg, push back on Dory. Because here's the thing that I've learned about the people in this building, and I can't say it's true for everybody else, is that certainly our opinions are malleable. You're a fool if they aren't.
Except for a certain set of core fundamental beliefs. I think I agree with what you're saying there. And in that spirit, let's move on to keep you updated on that story out of that Philadelphia Starbucks. As you heard there in the news segment, we now have audio of the 911 call. This is audio I haven't heard in full yet, so we're going to be hearing it live with you on the air. This was the 911 call made by a Starbucks employee about two black men who refused to leave after they were denied access to the bathroom and would not buy anything from the store. Here's what it sounds like.
Police, Arbiter 363, how may I help you?
Hi, I have two gentlemen at my cafe that are refusing to make a purchase or leave. I'm at the Starbucks at 18th and Spruce.
All right, police, I'll be out as soon as possible.
Thank you. Bye.
I mean, we don't get a whole lot of new information there necessarily.
Except for how rapidly, seemingly, they dispatched a couple of officers.
Yes, but do you know why that is? A private business is within their rights to so-called trespass anybody that is on their premises.
Yes.
So at the time being, the cops respond to a private business, and all they need is probable cause to show up to that business. And the court of law figures out the reasons why it happened later. So I actually, unless there's some new information that came out today that I'm not privy to, I think the cops acted appropriately and with dignity in the moment. There wasn't any excessive use of force here. All they know is they're getting a call from a private business, and it's their duty to remove these people.
Mm-hmm.
I heard they were kept and interrogated for quite a while, so I'm not going to justify that. Your take from the 911 call.
Well, I watched. I'm from the Philly area.
Uh-huh.
And I just watched. So born and raised an Eagles fan. I just watched the parade, where there were 500,000 people downtown, and even the weeks leading up to the Super Bowl, where there were people basically destroying the city for a while. There's a video that emerged of a guy actually. There was the one guy who punched a police horse. There was another guy who actually was trying to vandalize a police car. The latter guy never even got arrested. There is even amongst officers, the decision whether or not to move forward as a prosecutorial force.
Same rule applies to days that fall around the 4th of July and fireworks that
absolutely,
go off.
Absolutely. You make a choice who you want to go after, who you don't want to go after. But here's what I know about a Starbucks, is that especially in an area like Philadelphia or New York, any city, is that the default position of the Starbucks is anybody can come in and use the bathroom, because there's going to be hundreds of people use it every single day. What does it matter if it's 201 people or 202 people that use it? I've been in a Starbucks 1,000 times, and a bunch of times I went in to use the bathroom because sometimes that's the only reason you go in. And even when you have to get the code, I've never had an instance where a barista was like, oh, first you have to make a purchase. And in this instance, I don't know, but the fact that I can say anecdotally that I've never witnessed anyone have to go through this, and I've never gone through it myself, and once again, the people who had the officers called on them were young black men, there is a lot of questions that I think should be raised. And I think that Starbucks is making a wise decision, over as much of an overcorrection as you may think it is, to have all their employees come in, I think it's going to be a May 29th, and go through some kind of racial sensitivity training.
They're going to be closing all 8,000 of the company-owned stores in the United States. Mm-hmm. And this is all in an effort geared towards preventing discrimination. Their employees are going to receive implicit bias training. Have you done any studies or any research into implicit bias training? Because the research and the results from that research is very dubious at best.
Well, remember,
the correlation
last time,
between implicit bias and behavior, it's tough to draw an exact correlation. And even if you cure your implicit bias, it's tough to change behavior of any individual.
Well,
so
I guess the hope would be, right, that you realize you have the bias. And the bias may not be expunged, mm-hmm. but realize that you have it and overcome it. That's probably the best you can hope for. Remember the last time they went through bias training? It was supposed to be between the customer and the barista via a message that was written on the cup by the actual person that made your coffee.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't go over so well with Starbucks. I've never been through the training myself.
Did you take sexual harassment training here at Cairo? Because I did.
Yes.
And I watched a video that was like, is touching a woman on her bosom appropriate at the office?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I really got to think about this one for 5 or 6 minutes. Most of this stuff is so common sense. Don't ask black men to leave because of their race. I mean, it's the usefulness of this is suspect. And
I hope some of their training leaks, because I would hope that it would be more nuanced, because I would agree with you. And this is true of most companies that I work for, is they give you such egregious examples of sexual harassment or bias in the workplace that, of course, you know, it's the wrong thing.
But the thing is, to read into implicit bias is so difficult, because a lot of it is based on the perception of the person who is receiving the implicit bias.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what's the term besides safe spaces? Microaggressions. How do you quantify in a test tube exactly what a microaggression is? Well, it's in the eye of the person who's receiving that so-called microaggression. That applies to implicit bias, too. There's no way to measure it.
But if you're doing something that makes other people uncomfortable, wouldn't you want to change that behavior?
Every person, what they find uncomfortable depends on the individual, the respective individual. So it's almost impossible. What I'm more worried about here is Starbucks making an overcorrection because they fear the mob mentality and the backlash. I think that is a very troubling development.
They're just preempting it. And I don't
think they've already had boycott Starbucks. We've seen clips on the news today of people with loudspeakers yelling at Starbucks employees. That stuff's got to stop. I was making this point on the show yesterday. We still don't have a holistic view of what happened here, Zach. And patience is not a virtue in this society, but I need to make patience admirable again. It needs to come back in a big way, because everybody, we reward what is first and not necessarily what is right. We talked about that detective yesterday who pulled a gun on a motorcyclist over the summer. The investigation took months and months and months. And lo and behold, wait, they didn't have the full story right away. It turns out that motorcyclist was doing a lot of awful things on the road. It wasn't just, hey, this detective off duty is following this motorcyclist. And out of nowhere, he pulls a gun on him. He had a pretty strong reason for pulling a gun. So he was only given a 5-day suspension. That took a long, long time to get testimonies and videos. Some of the video had been fabricated or like edited a little bit to be favorable to the motorcyclist. A lot of that could take place with what happened here at Starbucks.
Okay, but we did have video of what happened, and clearly the other customers weren't upset. They were kind of as puzzled as anybody as to why they were being put in cuffs. You just heard the 911 call, hardly a panicked call.
Yeah, right.
Do we really have all the information? No, but I think that we can. What we do when we're talking about something with all the without all the information is we try to insinuate based on what the information that we have.
That's a slippery slope. Insinuations. All right, it's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in for Dory Monson. One more segment coming up. Stick around.
Happy, happy, joy, joy.
I like the song selection there, Sean.
Little Ren and Stimpy?
Yeah, thanks. It was very last minute. I just typed in happy into my computer, and hey, this is what came up.
The amount of prep you do for this program, Sean, is unmatched.
Unrivaled, thanks.
Yeah. So I wanted to get to the story in our last segment today. It turns out that not smiling doesn't actually make you look cooler. This is according to a new study published in the Journal of Consumer Psychology, and I gravitated towards this story because being in radio, every once in a while you get a chance to be in a photo with some type of celebrity. And for years and years, I used to have the biggest grin on my face whenever I would meet somebody famous. And I would look at the photos and I would see that the celebrities would kind of look ticked off. And I'd look like a moron, like the worst fanboy ever.
Yeah.
Two pictures in my memory particularly stick out. One was with the lead singer of Jimmy Eat World, and one was with the band Foster the People. They all have these straight, no-nonsense faces, and I'm like, hey, guys, I'm here for the photo. I learned my lesson. Here's a pro tip for all of you listening. If you ever run into a celebrity or meet somebody famous, just smirk a little bit. Do not show your teeth, and you will look like you are supposed to be in that photo. You will look like you are pals with that celebrity. Zach, what's your take on this?
I don't like the way I look when I smile in photographs. I don't like myself in photographs at all. I don't. I don't know how to smile when someone... I know how to smile in real life when it just happens naturally, but if you tell me cheese, I get this idiotic smile on my face like you have with the singer of Jimmy Eat World. And usually when you're meeting someone of prominence, whether they be a performer or a politician, they're not going to smile. They're going to kind of play it cool. I don't know if it's their PR people telling them to do so, or they don't want to be the ones who look really excited to be in the photograph.
Right, and I think that they're worried that years from then, if that picture exists on the internet and the person they've never met turns into a bad guy, then they're forever captioned in a photo where they have this massive smile. So I've seen some of the pictures you've taken because you've had a lot of big guests on Cairo Nights. You look a little angry, Zach.
I know.
You look a little angry to be there.
My headshot that's hanging in the hallway, I'm just glaring at the camera like I'm angry with the photographer.
Heed my advice. Just grin a little bit, but don't show teeth, and it'll look like you are pals with all these big names that you get on the show. My last photo was with Kevin Bacon, and I'm telling you, his smile was bigger than mine. And people were like, dude, like Greg and him must go back a long time. He looks like he's supposed to be there with Kevin Bacon. Smart philosophy.
It's a good one. I got to just stop with the glare. Again, like if I tried to smile right now, I would just look foolish.
Turn that frown upside down. Just
I hate looking foolish, Nicole.
It's great. You guys look great. You don't look like fools at all.
Oh, thanks.
Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns, I've had a lot of fun with you all, as I know Zach has as well. Stick around. Ron and Don coming up next. And Dory will be back soon.
I will not have this in my studio. You have failed conclusively. It's over. And there is nothing that you can do here in this room that can turn that around. Nothing you can do that can make up for what you just did.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.